This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today, I'm talking with Brad Krumholz about his book, Why Do Actors Train? Embodiment for Theater Makers and Thinkers. Brad, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So I feel like you're kind of setting me up for my first question, which is, why do actors train?
Read the book.
Okay, sounds good. Interview over. But I mean, in a serious sense, I mean, I'm a theater person. I'm a playwright, a occasional performer, but not really an actor. And I feel like from the outside, actor training can sometimes, I don't know, look a little silly. I don't think I'm probably the first one to point that out to you. So, what are actors doing in those rooms, and how is that supposed to translate to what they're doing on stage?
Sure. I mean, it's a pretty it's a question that breeds a lot of further questions. And so the way that the book is set up is it starts with this big question: why do actors train? And then we sort of dig in and say, okay, well, let's take an exercise for example, and we start with one little bit of an exercise, and then say, well, why? You know, another why question: why would an actor want to do this exercise? What's it for? You know, and then I try and answer that, and then it says, okay, well, what's, you know, then why? Why would they do that? And it's sort of getting deeper and deeper into these questions. But I would say that, you know, if I were to approach it from a, you know, a somewhat wide angle, I would say that what actors ultimately need to do, regardless of where they are and when they're doing it and what form or style they're working in, is that they need to behave on stage in the performance circumstance in a way that fits with the conventions of the time and place and form and allows them to become replete with meaning in a way that is not only acceptable to an audience, but also that really provides an audience with a certain kind of experience that allows like almost a direct link to the meaning making that's going on stage. And that meaning making happens on so many levels. It happens on the level of just basic, you know, can we understand what they're saying, the meaning of the words that they're saying on the most basic level. And then as you get deeper, you know, there's the meaning of their bodies, of the nonverbal communication. There's the meaning of what, you know, what's called prosody, which is the aspect of the language that doesn't come from the propositional meaning of the words themselves, but comes from the tone and the rhythm and the tempo and all of those flavors that we, you know, growing up in the world, we as human beings in society, we are enculturated to understand these things. We gain a lot of information from things that we have no idea that we're getting information from. Usually, I mean, unless you're studying it, you just sort of immersed in this world of meaning. And as people living in the world, gets used to understanding that world and, you know, more or less, you know, to greater or lesser degrees, depending on who you are. And, you know, the theatrical circumstance is not a quote unquote natural one. And yet it is also a natural one in that it exists, you know, in the natural world. There's people, there's real stuff on stage or what, you know, but it's not just observing things in daily life. It is not real. It is realistic. But it follows certain conventions, a certain system of conventions, and those conventions change over time and from place to place. But the audience that is from that place and that time also understands what is right inside of those conventions and what isn't right, what works inside of those conventions and what doesn't work inside of those conventions. And they oftentimes process this almost always on a completely unconscious level. And so the actor needs to learn how, somehow, needs to be able to, whether they've learned it, you know, accidentally or they learn it through training, they need to be able to live fully inside of the fictive circumstances and become replete with meaning in a way that does not point to itself in a way that will take the audience out of the experience. And just the final note is, even if the style is intended to sort of alienate, like sort of in a Brechtian sense, the audience from that experience, that is still a convention that the actor is working inside of. And that is the convention they have to work inside of. They have to work within the rules of that convention in order to do that thing perfectly well. Mm-hmm.
So I take it you're not therefore kind of assuming that what it means to, you know, perform meaningfully is to kind of merge with the character and feel the things that they're feeling at the exact same time they're feeling them in a kind of, I don't know, vulgar Stanislavskian sense, right?
Definitely not. Most certainly not. Which isn't to say that can't necessarily happen. I mean, I have my own sort of critiques or understandings of what that is as a director and as a theater maker myself. I have my own views on whether that's, you know, good or not or whatever. But the book itself is not an endorsement of one style over another. It is really saying that if someone is going to act inside of a formal convention, and everything on stage is a formal convention, then they just need to know how to do it well. And so actor training is the way for people to get better at it. If they don't already know how to do it. And I've said that already, you know, in this conversation, that, you know, you don't need to train necessarily for certain aspects of performance. There are lots of people who can just, you know, all of a sudden they're just like, oh my God, they're just a natural actor. You know, they've got natural talent, whatever you want to call it. But that's just because they know how to do these things already. But if you don't know how to do them, and there are lots of things to not know how to do, there are pedagogical techniques that are designed to help actors learn how to do these things. And those techniques are not boilerplate. They're always an encounter between a skilled teacher and a student actor. And, you know, even something like, the Strasbergian method acting, it's not just like there's this formula and you can just follow it by like going, you know, okay, step one, step two, step three. It has to be done in relation to somebody who's guiding through it and really responding to the momentary experience of the performer and the actor and what they're trying to do and where they're succeeding and where they're not succeeding and what they're coming up against as an obstacle and how to overcome that obstacle. And so there's a constant sort of improvisational nature inside of the formalistic training. And so I talk a lot about that in the book as well.
This is not a question I was planning to ask, but just kind of based on what you just said, it seems like that might be part of the reason. I mean, you're kind of suggesting that acting training, you know, needs that kind of dialogic element to it. Is that part of the reason why, you know, so many acting books, even written by people who are, you know, demonstrably great acting teachers, kind of fail on the page. I mean, I'm thinking of like Harold Clurman saying the thing that he read from reading An Actor Prepares is that Stanislavski can't write, you know? I mean, or even, you know, the Strasberg books are okay, but you kind of don't really understand how those insights were able to produce or train the great actors that came out of his studio. Is that part of what's going on here?
At some level, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, Stanislavski wasn't teaching from a book. You know, he was engaging with people in the studio, and he was figuring it out. He was saying, okay, that's a great example of like encountering convention. It was a new convention that was coming into realism was just developing at the turn of the century. And he was responding to that saying, oh my goodness, how are we going to make these plays live? And so he's responding in the living moment to those things. And then in relation to the actors that he was working with, he was coming up with all sorts of crazy ways of getting people to approach something like, I don't speak Russian, but there's a word that's called perezhvenie, I think it's pronounced. And I talk about that in my book as well. And it has to do with being in the moment in a certain kind of flow, a certain kind of living flow of embodying the role. He was doing that in a moment to moment basis. And, you know, I don't know if you know that old story about Stella Adler going to see him, in mm-hmm. France after she had already worked with Strasberg in the group theater for a while. Do you know this one?
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know if all of our listeners will. So maybe you could rehearse a short version of it.
At least the apocryphal story is that she went over there and, you know, she is introduced finally to Stanislavski, whom she'd heard so much about. This is in like 19. You know, they first encountered his work in New York in 1934, I think it was. And then some years went by and she met him and she said, Mr. Stanislavski, you've ruined me. You've ruined my life. And he says, why? And she says, well, because, you know, working with, you know, with what I have learned from you has completely made my relationship to acting miserable. It has completely taken all the joy and all the life out of my experience as an actor. And he said, oh no, this is terrible. We need to fix this. And then he's invited her to stay with him and work with him. And he worked with her one-on-one in order to encounter what it was that she was encountering, you know, in those moments of difficulty in order to get her beyond that into something that was working for her. And it was a pivotal moment in her development as an actor and a teacher and all that.
I feel like I'm just asking you to clarify what you're not saying so far, but I do have one other question in that line, which is, you know, you talk about how part of being a good actor is kind of fulfilling the conventions of your moment and maybe your genre. Are you then suggesting that acting training must necessitate learning as many different types of like sort of conventions of acting as possible? Or are you more saying something like, you know, the claim that you'll sometimes hear like British actors making, which is something like, you know, if you can do Twelfth Night, you can do anything.
Well, I wouldn't say if you can do Twelfth Night, you can do anything. And I also wouldn't say, you know, if you can do Streetcar Named Desire, you can do Twelfth Night. I would say that especially something like Shakespeare really requires, I mean, Shakespeare itself it definitely requires training because it's so completely removed from the analog of our daily experience. I mean, just the language itself is old and antiquated and foreign. There's meter, you know, there's so much going on there, stylistically and formalistically that one needs to learn how to encounter in order for it to fly. And there's also so many conventional expectations that people have when they're encountering Shakespeare. And so, you know, when you see a Shakespeare that is, that's innovative, let's call it, you know, that goes against the grain of convention, it oftentimes creates a big kerfuffle. Because people are saying, oh my God, you can't do Shakespeare like that. And so, well, of course you can, but you're just not expecting it. And so you need to enculturate the audience into a new way of doing Shakespeare. Even if it's just for one performance, you have to, in that performance, you've got to find a way to work with whatever the expectations are and then find a way to get that audience to accept the new approach to the form that you're presenting in a very short amount of time. But to go back to your question, I maybe we could compare it, and I do a little bit of this in the book, to musicianship. So if you're learning to play piano, there are scales that one, you know, scales and exercises and that one can learn and practice. And you practice the scales and the etudes, and you're working with a teacher who's working with your form and your ability, and your whole instrument is over time through hours and hours, thousands of hours of practicing. You get to a point where you are able to play a piece of music, right? That's written on the page, notated in the tablature of the page. You learn how to take that and translate it into the motion of your whole body, which is, you know, focused in the fingers in these moments, but it's really a whole body experience of playing the piano. And your whole body is responding and playing that music, and is what is emerging is not just it's not just technically proficient. It's also somehow expressive. You know, one can use the word sort of transcendent. It transcends just the pure mechanics of it. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts in that circumstance. Now, a piano player, a really expert piano player, should be able to play anything. But it's also true, as we know, that, you know, there's some piano players who are classically trained, who are classical piano players, and some who are jazz pianists. And while there is the possibility potentially of sort of going back and forth between those styles, generally you just kind of stick with one form, and you become an expert in jazz playing, or you become an expert in classical playing. Sometimes, you know, I don't know that much about it, and so the limits of my analogy kind of end there. But but my understanding is that that someone who can go back and forth between the two of them is a pretty rare example. And I would say the same thing for any artist, that artists work inside of a style. And they can master many of them, but usually what happens is that they do it over time. I mean, if you look at Jackson Pollock's work, for example, I mean, he went through phases of, you know, really very clear realist forms early on, and then as time went on, it became more and more abstract. I imagine he never lost the ability to do those early forms, but he had to learn how to do them. And there's lots of evidence of him practicing and practicing and practicing. And then eventually he grows into another style and invents it and becomes the master of that. And, you know, so I don't know if that answers your question, but maybe it approaches an answer.
Yeah, I think so. Another thing you talk about a lot in the book is this idea of embodied cognition. This seems to have been a very helpful kind of frame for you to think about what exactly is going on in a rehearsal room or in a studio. So could you tell us a bit about kind of what embodied cognition means, and then also kind of how that has been helpful for you in thinking about what you're doing in the classroom or in the rehearsal room?
Sure. Embodied cognition is, in my book, I refer to somebody else referring to it as a program rather than as a field or as a discipline, because there are many, many different people who use it in different ways. And it appears in psychology. It also appears in philosophy. But basically what and there are also many different approaches to what embodied cognition is. There's not like one definition. It's like, oh, this is embodied cognition and everything else is not. But ultimately, there are certain common elements to various things that are connected to embodied cognition. And probably the primary one is that it goes against the Cartesianist belief or understanding of the human being as a binary, a dualistic combination of mind and body. So that on one hand we're part mind, and on the other hand we're part body. And in the Cartesianist framework, these two substances, as they're called in philosophy, they coexist, but they don't. They're not the same. They're not part of the same system. And so, you know, Descartes really is quite complex, and I say Cartesianist instead of Cartesian because there's a lot inside of Descartes that actually goes against what came to be called Cartesianist afterwards. He and the people who followed him launched this sort of way of approaching the world that and really made it sort of fundamental to how people see themselves in the world, where, you know, we have these bodies that go around and do the stuff, like they move things and they procreate and they feel pleasure and they eat, you know, all of the stuff of the world. They sort of navigate us through the world and get us things, and we hold on to things and hit things and all that sort of thing. And then we have these minds. And the minds are kind of seen these days as the sort of computer center in which all of the thinking that we do and all of the language stuff and the imagination and all of that kind of exists. It's kind of meant to exist in some kind of disembodied mind space, just kind of floating out there. And we point to our heads, you know, when we say, oh, we're thinking, and we kind of imagine that it's kind of just up there somewhere, and these words are kind of floating around, and maybe there are letters. We don't know. Like, nobody really thinks about it in the daily world. But there's a fundamental problem with this, and that it's just not true. And what modern contemporary philosophy has come to terms with, you know, they come to terms with it quite some time ago, is that there's no separation. There's no substance dualism. There's no difference between the substance of the mind and the substance of the body. That actually, you need to look at things in a completely different way. And so embodied cognition understands human experience, human cognition, the way that we exist in the world, as a fully embodied, fully felt interaction with the environment. And that the brain is part, it's physical, it's part of our body. It's actually part of the substance of our body, and it connects to our spine, which connects to the nerves and into the muscles and all of that. Like, we are one big entity that's moving around in the world. And our movement through the world with our senses and all of the bodily elements, including the brain, which is its own very specific kind of organ, it is that interaction and that movement through the world and all those relationships that we encounter in the moments that they're happening that makes up mind. That mind is fully embodied. And this approach is that's the radical shift. That's the radical shift that I'm pushing for in this book. And I'm not the first person to do this in relation to actor to the work of theater, but it's certainly not... it's not necessarily a mainstream view, and I would say that in general, people are kind of behind the curve, and that theater studies is quite behind the curve, and just in general, people, I hate to speak in generalities, I really try and avoid it, but it's true that, you know, if you were to go and ask 10 people, like, you know, do you have a mind that's separate from the body, most of them would be like, yeah, of course. You know, they wouldn't understand that the mind is actually part of the embodied experience in the world, and it's part and parcel of it, and that there can be no mind without embodiment, and there can be no sense of body without with this sort of, let's call it, mental function that goes along with it. And so I know this is kind of, it's a little convoluted what I'm saying, because it's quite complex, but I think I give the general idea, and the point of applying this to theater is to say, all right, well, if it's true that we, you know, that our minds are embodied, then what does it mean for, you know, how one approaches, say, a role while acting? There's been, you know, there's so much history inside of the world of theater and actor training, which talks about psychological realism and about, you know, imagining, you know, using the imagination and using emotion, which is also, emotion is kind of seen as like kind of physical, but it's also kind of like connected to the mind. It's kind of a mental process. And there's this whole thing of, you know, like, actors are, you know, often referred to as, like, in the pejorative sense, as like talking heads. You know, you've got these plays where actors are on stage and they're saying all of the words and the language and everything, but they don't know what to do with their bodies, and they're just kind of standing around. And I'm not saying that good actors ever do this, but there is a sense in which that the language-based theater is somehow the theater of the mind. And then there's this other thing called physical theater, which is the theater of the body. And even inside of our own sort of formalistic categories, we separate them out, you know, and it's silly, and it's just not true. And, you know, there is this thing called physical theater because we've created this thing called physical theater, but the line between the physical and the mental, the physical and the verbal, is just, there's no line at all. As a matter of fact, verbal theater is entirely embodied. You need a whole body in order to make a voice. It is not just something that exists in the mind. It's not something that just exists in the mouth. It is an entire body that is required for that. And so my approach is constantly urging the reader and the actor to rethink their relationship to what it is they're doing with this new concept, with this new conception, with this new way of saying, oh, right. You know, when I approach this character, when I approach this language, when I approach this text, how is it possible to do that in a fully embodied way? Or even more to the point, how is it that what I am doing as I am doing this is fully embodied already? And how can I, in order to get better at it, how can I approach it with, you know, better with the knowledge that it is fully embodied? Because if you have the wrong conception of what it is you're doing, then what are you doing? You're doing something that's misguided, at least on some level.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah. And this is really interesting because I have an image in my head of, you know, an acting teacher who's sort of a conglomerate of all the acting teachers I've ever had. And I feel like this person that I'm imagining wouldn't think of themselves as some sort of a, you know, hardcore Cartesian dualist, you know, would think of themselves as somebody who values the fact that we have a body and that does important work, but would still say things like, you know, stop thinking and just act, or just be present, or get out of your head, right? And that does sort of imply that, you know, maybe not on a fully philosophical level, but at least on a kind of, you know, commonsensical level, a lot of these acting teachers do have a sense of, you know, the mind and the body as being separate. Even if they're maybe, you know, valorizing the body part of that more than the mind part, they are still erecting a separation, right?
I 100% agree. And I think one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is to offer a lens through which people who are teaching, for example, can understand what they're doing in a little bit of a different way. Because if you were to ask some of these teachers that you refer to, like your teachers, would you, you know, you say, if you ask them what their stance on Cartesianism is, they might, you know, after a moment or maybe immediately say like, oh no, there is, you know, there's obviously, yes, of course, there's no mind-body split. We are fully embodied, blah, blah, blah. But they're because there's a paucity of that kind of approach inside of pedagogical technique and in technique in general, it's not steering the ship. That knowledge is not steering the ship. It's kind of like left behind somewhere in the wake. And so I guess one of the things I'm trying to do is to say, hey, look at this. Look at what it is that we are already doing. How can we understand it differently? And then how can that actually affect your ability to teach better, to lead people through their obstacles in a way that is actually more in tune with what's going on with them or on the organ, on the level of their organism? And, you know, all organisms are also social organisms. There's no human organism outside of society. There's no uninculturated human organism. You know, the closest thing we have to that is like Tarzan, and even Tarzan had, you know, had a society of apes. You know, but and it's fiction, but But all, you know, all human organisms are social and socialized and enculturated. And at the same time, they are also fully embodied. And so if you have a teacher who's able to see all of that and to really understand what's going on with an actor, with a student in a given moment in relation to these questions, I think that they would be better situated to sort of help them, to help them grow.
Another thing that occurred to me reading your book is that it seems like performance studies might be an especially kind of fruitful field to apply embodied cognition to, because with very few exceptions, performance studies is a field that is done by people who are both kind of scholars and practitioners. I mean, like yourself, you have written this book that's drawing on, you know, theory and philosophy, and yet you're also a director and you teach acting. And that's true of most people in this field, that there are very few people who are sort of pure theorists in performance studies. Is that part of the reason why you sort of want to bring these two in closer dialogue?
I wouldn't say it's part of the reason why I want to, but I would be glad to know about it happening. I think part of the reason why I want to do it is for general people in general who are interested in this kind of work to just to understand things a little bit differently. And also, I mean, maybe more along the lines of what you're saying is there's this one part of the book where I refer to who I refer to I'm losing it. This is one scholar, and it'll come to me in a second, who talks about the really problematic distinction that is made inside of actor training programs, where you've got movement, you know, you've got movement in one classroom, and then you've got voice in another classroom, and then you've got character in another classroom, and you know, maybe some actors in a program take a little bit of one and a little bit of another, but there's not necessarily a real sense of how they're all integrated, aside from the fact that it's up to the actor, the student themselves to sort of figure it out, you know, and to say like, oh, well, I'm taking my movement class on Mondays and Wednesdays, and taking my voice class on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Then I've got my character class in the next semester. And I'm the one who's the common element, you know, who's experiencing all these things. And so somehow they must be working on me in some way. But really, you know, it's like you just said, like, oh, leave your mind outside of the classroom. You know, in the movement classes, like, leave your brain outside, you know, don't overthink all these kinds of things. Like, it would be just so much better if a program could be designed that was designed based in embodiment, that was based in the fundamental understandings of embodiment that I'm talking about in the book, for example. And so the program itself is designed in order to help the actors synthesize and live through all of this stuff and understand where their strengths are and where their weaknesses are and where they need to move in relation to a much more holistic approach. And I know that programs are always seen as holistic, but I still would say that Joe Roach is the guy's name, Joseph Roach. that, you know, as he said in one of his books, he talks about the harebrained nature of this kind of separation between these disciplines that exists to this day in so many training programs. And so I would love to see a world in which that changes. I would love to see a world in which in which that approach is more fully understood. And also, I think, you know, maybe this is also an important point, is that there are two things that I'm hoping also that my book can lead to on one, you know, at least be a part of a change in the culture at large inside of actor training. One of them is, you know, the problematic nature of psychological realism, and specifically the method, and at least in some forms of the method, and how it sort of like it requires people to in a kind of disembodied way to approach their memories and things like that, that often creates a lot of emotional and psychological problems inside of the actor as they're doing these things. It's getting better over time, but this is a sort of a longstanding problem. And then the other thing is, you know, a lot of the times the actor student experience is incredibly mystified in that they're told to do things and they don't exactly know why. And they're said, oh, that's working and that's not working. And they don't really understand why. And ultimately they become something like a pawn that is, you know, this sort of manipulated, as it were, by the professor. And there's a lot of exploitation historically that has happened and continues to happen inside of that circumstance. And whether it's exploitation with a, you know, writ large, or whether it's just these sort of micro exploitations in which the actor, the acting student is just meant to trust the outside eye of the director, it really puts the human actor at a disadvantage, and it really sort of disempowers them from understanding what it is they're doing and why they're doing it. And it's not like we can't understand why we do certain things inside of actor training. It's just that nobody, not too many people have articulated it. And so I feel like if I can articulate it and people can really understand what it is, then they can look at what they're doing and have some kind of ownership over the process, and to say, oh, yes, this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. And this is why it's working well. And this is why it's not working well.
And one thing that also does, obviously, is just create this very hierarchical relationship where all of the sort of knowledge is held by the instructor and is never really fully transferred over to the student who's meant to apply it in their own acting career.
Exactly. And this, you know, it's just really unhealthy. It's sort of this guru model in yeah. which, you know, there's a little bit of worship going on there. There's a lot of charisma that happens, and it's just not necessary. Not only is it not necessary, it's just kind of harmful and gross.
Yeah, for sure. Could you talk a bit more practically about how this understanding of embodied cognition actually affects some of the specific exercises that you teach and that you talk about in this book?
Sure. Well, the way the book is organized is there are five sections. There's the overview section at the beginning, which talks about embodied cognition and what it is and sort of how I'm approaching everything in the book. And then at the end, there's a section that I call afterthinking, which is sort of a look back at the things that I didn't really get to talk about too much in the book itself. And that would require maybe other volumes. But then the main body, three chapters, each one is devoted conceptually to a particular area of theory and also is grounded in its own exercise. And so I choose three exercises, one for what chapter, for the first body chapter, one for the second body chapter, and one for the third body chapter. And they're exercises that I either developed on my own as a teacher and director over the many years that I've been practicing, and, you know, or one that I've learned during that time that I've been teaching a lot. And so I just know it really well. I think the important thing is that these are just exercises that have clear elements that I know really well. And in my mind, they can, you know, you don't need to know what these exercises are in order to understand what's going on. My hope, at least, is that someone who doesn't know the exercises but is familiar with exercises of their own could read it and say, oh, okay, I don't know this one, but the explanation for why it works actually makes a lot of sense to me because I know this other exercise that's kind of similar to it. I mean, to get a little bit more into detail, to respond to your question, there's this one exercise that I talk about, which is one that I invented called the three layers. And it sort of, simply put, the three layers that are in the exercise happen sequentially, but they don't, but once you finish one layer, you add the second layer to it. And then on top of that, or with that, you add the third layer so that by the end of it, you're doing all three layers at the same time. The first layer is the layer of the senses, mainly seeing, hearing, the feeling of touch with the skin, and mainly that. Those are the three main senses that I deal with. I don't really deal with the
taste and smell.
I don't deal with taste at all. Smell, like, yeah, a little bit. You know, smell is kind of secondary, but and I do incorporate that sometimes. But mainly it's those three. And what I do is I ask the actors to engage in some very, very basic, just being there and awakening those senses. And then the second layer is beginning as you move around the space to pay attention to the joints of the body on the inside and how they are moving and releasing around the tension around the joints and finding a freedom in the joints, sort of scanning through the whole body. And then the third layer is the movement of the movement in space in relation to the environment and the other people in the room. So it's the layer of the space. So with that as a general framework of the exercise, what I'll point to is that one of the things that happens is that there becomes a battle of attention, a sort of internal battle of attention inside of the doer. Whenever you add a new layer, it all of a sudden becomes very difficult to get to pay attention to the one you were just doing. So, you know, even if you're just going from like, okay, you're looking around the space, you're seeing with your eyes, you're really taking in, you know, moving, like looking around, seeing details of the space. As soon as you add in, even inside of the first layer, as soon as you add in the hearing, then all of a sudden you stop seeing. I mean, not everyone does this, but the tendency in general is that there's this tension between even just these two sensory modalities. And, you know, and so the effort of the exercise is to find a way that you can be alive in your seeing at the same time as being fully alive in what you were hearing, and understanding that these two modalities are habitually, they are not working in tandem with each other, but through the exercise, you have the ability to make them work in tandem with each other. And this is generally geared towards a more full functioning of the sensory modalities inside of the actor. And then inside of the book, what I do is I say, okay, well, back to the question, why is it? Why is it that one would need to do this as an actor? Who cares? What's the point? Well, there's a theorist whom I really love. His name is Alvin Noe, and he's part of a group of people, but he's one of the prominent people in this group that talks about this idea of inactive perception or inactivism. And the idea behind inactive perception is that perception is action, and action is perception, and that the process of perceiving with our various perceptual modalities is actually a fully embodied action in the space, and requires a certain kind of physical know-how in order to be able to perceive. I sort of pull apart and tease a lot of the complexity of this concept, but you know, if you just use that as a basic, you know, idea of what he's talking about, then what you soon discover is that training of the actor, right? The word act is inside of is sort of the core of acting and actor training, and the actor to act in the world is to perceive. And if you have the ability to perceive in the world, in order to develop that, you need to be able to move through the world with a certain kind of know-how and facility, and vice versa. In order to be able to move through the world with a certain kind of know-how and facility, you need to be able to develop all your perceptual modalities to the fullest extent possible. Now, I just say also that, you know, that everyone has a different set of perceptual modalities available to them. Some people don't have the sense of sight. Some people have different kinds of sense of sight. Some people don't have hearing. But I would say that each individual has their own set, and that set is built in with their way of moving through the world. And so that know-how, their ability to do things in the world, is bound up with the limitations that they have of their own set, and their own set can actually be developed in relation to their moving through the world. And so I want to sort of strike the notion that this is that there's any kind of ableism involved in the theory that I'm putting forth. It really is taking into account all of the differences that each person has, and I'm working on the level of neurology and neuroscience here. And so, so there are certain things that, you know, everybody more or less has, and that's kind of like the field that I'm working in.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Great. I'd also like to know a bit about how writing this book affected your own teaching and your work with your theater company, if it did, or maybe is this book more kind of a summary of things that you knew, that you learned along the process of teaching that you then wanted to kind of record in the book. Did the writing of the book itself change your artistic and pedagogical work?
I would say it's really been a lifelong fascination for me. But I didn't necessarily know what the fascination was in the way that I do now. I remember, so I run a company called North American Cultural Laboratory, or NACL as it's known, in in the world. And it's, I co-founded it in 1997. And shortly after that, we started a journal, which is kind of like, at the time, it was like an 11 by 17 sort of paper, the one, two sides of an 11 by 17 paper with lots of little articles on it. And we sort of sent it out as a newsletter for our company. Anyway, it was called the Periodic Table, to kind of go along with the NaCl, sodium chloride thing. And in one of the early periodic tables, which must have been like, I don't know, like around 2000 or before, probably around 2000, I wrote an article called The Art of Picking Up a Cup. It was a short little essay, but in that I was talking about some of the things that I've ended up 30 years later writing about in this book. About there's even this one section where I refer to in Why Do Actors Train, I refer to what an actor needs to be able to do in order to pick up a cup convincingly. And I use the example of, you know, on one hand, you know, the cup is supposed to be full of hot liquid, or the cup is full, or the cup has a tarantula in it, or a scorpion. And, you know, it's not that the cup has any of those things, but the actor's imagination, that the actor's embodied imagination needs to be able to let the audience believe that that is what's going on with that cup. And so in order for an actor to pick up a cup as if there's a tarantula in it, for example, there's a whole fully embodied network of things that need to happen on a very, very micro level that the actor needs to be able to do in order to convincingly portray the sense that there is, you know, that there's this potentially deadly tarantula inside of this cup that this character is going to pick up. So, you know, I started writing about that a long time ago, but from the level of, really just from the level of my interest in the body that I was engaged with then. And then over time, I eventually went to grad school and I went to the PhD program at the CUNY Graduate Center. And I started taking philosophy classes. And all of a sudden, I encountered this whole world of embodied cognition. I said, oh my God, all of the things that these philosophers are talking about are so directly applicable to theater and to theater training and all the stuff that I've been fascinated with my whole life. And that's when I decided to write my dissertation on it. I thought, oh, well, nobody, you know, there's one amazing philosopher named Mark Johnson, who I believe teaches out at University of Oregon. You know, he writes a book called The Meaning of the Body and Aesthetics of Understanding. And inside of the book, he talks about the relationship between aesthetic pursuits and this kind of embodied cognition approach. But he only talks about music and visual art, music and poetry, I think. And he kind of mentions dance once, but he doesn't mention theater at all. He doesn't mention any dance aside from this one moment. And I'm thinking to myself, how is it possible that this brilliant man who's understanding so much about embodiment inside of the arts is not approaching the one art form that is the most fully embodied of all of them? Like, it's using all of the faculties that we have, including voice and all of this. He's just not writing about it. So I said, oh, well, I need to take his work as a starting point and move forward with it. And so it's a long answer to your question. It's deepened my obsession. And it's given me a way, writing this book has given me a way to talk about these things in a way that I feel is grounded in a certain kind of knowledge that I can point to. And it's helped me understand the world and also the world of theater in a deeper way, but it hasn't redirected me in any way.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for that answer, Brad.
Sure.
I think we're about at the end of our time. I just want to remind our listeners one more time that the title of the book is Why Do Actors Train? Embodiment for Theater Makers and Thinkers by Brad Krumholz. And Brad, thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about your wonderful new book.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.